Alaska doesn't have adequate law enforcement. There aren't enough officers in small villages. And recent reporting by the Anchorage Daily News shows that some of the people who are hired to keep communities safe are the ones who end up causing the problems. It's a long-term issue that's worsened with state budget cuts. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what's happening to make rural Alaska safer.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Providing enough well-trained, properly vetted law enforcement in rural Alaska has been a challenge for a long time. Today, we'll talk about why and what's being done to solve the problem. My guests today are Department of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, Village Public Safety Officer Captain Andrew Merrill, and Chris Hatch, the VPSO Coordinator for the Northwest Arctic Borough. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
And to our listeners, what do you think should be done to improve local law enforcement in rural Alaska? Share your ideas by calling 1-800-478-8255 statewide or 550-8422 in Anchorage. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So I'd like to start with laying out the basics. Commissioner Monaghan, what kind of law enforcement is available in rural communities?
Well, currently, we certainly have the Alaska State Troopers that are just about everywhere except the North Slope at the moment. They have their own public safety up there. And then there is the Village Public Safety Officer Program, the VPSOs, which Trooper Captain Merrill is in charge of. And then there is also the Village Police Officers and Tribal Police Officers.
So a lot of different categories. How are they all different? How are they all the same?
Well, the Alaska State Troopers are going to be the ones that probably they have the responsibility constitutionally to provide public safety to the entire state. And the VPSOs, or the Village Public Safety Officers, they're the ones that primarily were to be assigned to a community or several communities close by and function within that particular community. VPOs, or village police officers, are specific to one village, as well as tribal police officers to a specific tribe. Though VPOs and TPOs, sometimes they will, again, migrate if there's another community that is in need of service, and it's in conjunction with whatever the villages cooperate with.
Mm-hmm. And so, Captain Merrill, VPSOs, what kind of... How do their roles differ than from a state trooper? Like, what kinds of things do they do on a daily basis?
So when the VPSO program started, the initial idea and concept was to hire somebody that lived in the community that could provide that broad-based public safety service. And so they, there wasn't enough, typically in a village of 200 or 300 people, there wasn't enough law enforcement work to keep them busy. And so the state, when we developed the program, said, hey, we'll hire someone, we'll give them multiple services they can provide. So that's where the EMS, the Emergency Medical Services, and the fire safety came in. And so VPSOs are certified as peace officers, as well as they receive a fire certification. And then they receive their at least a minimum of ETT, emergency trauma technician training. Some go beyond that to EMT to do that broad base of all three of those functions. And so troopers aren't trained EMTs, we're not trained firefighters, and so our focus is law enforcement, while the VPSOs have that broad-based service that they provide. And so that's one of the big differences between the troopers and the VPSOs. And so in the villages, one of the ways we kind of describe it when I talk to people is it's kind of like the health aide and a doctor. Health aides provide an in-community service that is a lot more personal, and the doctors are kind of they receive the more technical training on some of those more difficult cases. And so that's kind of one of the differences that we use as an example to help people kind of understand it. But the VPSOs provide that broad-based service in the community.
So, I mean, really a VPSO is kind of a many people wrapped into one.
Correct.
So, Mr. Hatch, you work with VPSOs all across the Northwest Arctic. You've been one yourself. How do you prepare someone for a job that encompasses so many different things?
Lots of training.
the job is to be a first responder. You have to be prepared to work with everyone in your community, build those partnerships, work with the troopers, and get help coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's the job.
I'd like you to expand a little bit on that, because you're talking, you say build those partnerships. Talk about the partnerships, please.
So when I'm alone in a community, as a law enforcement officer or firefighter, I may be the only person trained in either of those skills. I may be the only EMT in the community. So you can't respond to a fire alone. It takes teamwork. You have to build a fire department. You have to get partnerships to work with you during a law enforcement episode. So someone gets hurt in the community, someone assaults someone else, you arrest them. You need a prisoner. You need someone to guard the prisoner, excuse me. When you fight a fire, you need a team to fight that fire. So you have to build partnerships within the community, with the community government, with the health aides, whoever it may be.
So how do you train someone to build those partnerships? Like, is that built into the training?
It's built into the field training we give them. We have to work with them to teach them to talk to people. Mm-hmm. We go into the schools. We spend a lot of time working with the kids and the students. We give classes. We teach our guys to give classes in firearm safety, cold water survival, various courses, basic life support, CPR. And those things are used to build contacts and communication between the officer and the community.
And so another thing that you mentioned, Captain Merrill, was like these are people who are ideally – are these people who are ideally from the area, or are you importing people?
So ideally, yes. The program was designed to do that. One of the things we're finding in recent years is that's not the norm now. It used to be a lot of our VPSOs came from the community they lived in, and they served that community. We're finding now that a lot of either individuals in the community don't qualify to be a VPSO, or they choose not to be a VPSO. It's a difficult job. I worked in Bethel and Nome for multiple years during my career, and I have a VPSO friend who's not a VPSO anymore, but and then one of the reasons for that is he lived in a community of 250 people, and he was related to everybody. And so when he was arresting people, he was arresting cousins and uncles and brothers and sisters, and so it was difficult for him to sustain that long term. And so what we're finding right now is about 50% of our VPSOs are not from the communities that they live in. Like I said, it's about 50-50 break right now between those who grew up in the community and live in the community and they now are a VPSO, and the other 50% are people who come from other regions or other parts of the country.
I know it's really hard to make generalizations, but I'm going to ask you to. Is there any sort of sense of, are you having more success one way or another? Or is it just too individual?
I think it's too individual. It depends. We worked with UAA and we did a study on different types. So we selected different types of VPSOs. And so in the study, they selected four VPSOs. One VPSO was a VPSO who lived in the community that they grew up in and was a short-term VPSO. That means they served less than 2 years.
Mm.
And so they did some research in the community about that VPSO.
Okay.
And the next VPSO was a VPSO who didn't live in the community, was an import, and it was there for less than 2 years. And then the other two were a VPSO similar, one that had lived in the community but was a long-term VPSO, so more than 10 years. And the other one was a VPSO who was not from the community but was long-term as well. And so the interesting thing was that studies said it really didn't matter where they were from. What mattered was their partnerships and the relationships in the community.
Mm-hmm.
A successful VPSO, regardless of where they come from, builds that community relationship. And the same holds true for troopers as well. Having worked in Western Alaska, I know that when I went out and I had tea with the elders, or if I brought them oranges or I brought them apples, and I sat and I met with the community mm-hmm. members, I had a lot better relationship and I was able to accomplish more in the community than if I just went in, arrested somebody and left. And
mm-hmm.
so we find success with our VPSOs. It doesn't really matter, like I said, where they're from, if they're an import or not, if they build those skills and build the relationships with the communities.
So then when you're recruiting, are you looking for different personality traits than you would if you were looking for a trooper?
Yes and no. It is. It's a different job. And so mm-hmm. it requires different, different personality traits, different abilities sometimes. And so, yeah, we look at, ultimately right now, though, we're just looking for anybody that's willing.
Oh.
Because recruitment across law enforcement in general is substantially hampered right now by a lot of different things. There's a lot of social things. There's a lot of work things. There's a lot of salary, pay, and benefit kind of things that are, you compile that all together. And so we're finding that we don't have the applicant pools that we used to have. And so now it's a matter of weeding through all the people who apply and finding those who have the skill sets and have the temperament to do what we ask them to do.
Mm-hmm. And Commissioner Monaghan, would you like to build on that?
Well, that's true. It's a national phenomenon right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of the departments across America are having a difficult time filling their ranks. And so some of them are going to pretty outrageous lengths in huge hiring bonuses or all sorts of relocations, reductions on homes, whatever they can do to attract people to come and stay. And we experienced that as well. We're, in the last few years, because of the situation the state has been in financially, you know, we probably didn't look like a good bet if you were from some other state thinking about coming up here. But as we are recovering, and some of the distance between us and some of the social issues that was pretty well publicized down in the States, we're seeing more.
What do you mean some of the social issues that were pretty?
Well, things like, you know, every time that a police officer did something that somebody objected to, then there was a lot of video, and that was played in by the media.
So I'm assuming you mean police killing, police
shootings. Mm-hmm. Correct. Any type of perceived misbehavior by police officers, you know, and police are human. You know, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to make mistakes. We all make mistakes. And the trick that we try to do is, since we function and must have public trust, is that when we do, we owe up to it, we address it, we do it quickly, we do it transparently, and try to make up for any mistakes we have made in the past. And because you can't be effective as a police officer if you're not trusted.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that is kind of a fading now in regards to the media spotlight. And so more and more people are starting to apply. We're seeing more applicants up here. And I think like last year, for example, when I first got here, maybe 2 years ago, we had like four troopers in our ALETS Academy or Alaska Law Enforcement Training Academy and down in Sitka. And this year, this next coming year, we're looking at maybe as many as about 30. So we're trying to, I think we turned the corner and we're starting to build our staff back up. And mm-hmm. we hope that trend continues because we're still about 30-some-odd positions, 37 vacancies currently at the moment.
Just within troopers?
That's correct. And that's about 10% of our force.
Wow.
So we need, when we're fully staffed, even then, with our authorized position, we're still basically insufficiently staffed to handle the load we're asked to do. And we try to make up the difference by doing more visits. For example, we got money in the budget from last year. Thank you, legislature and governor. We got about $1 million more that we can travel with. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily just to go find somebody and arrest them, but, mm-hmm. you know, to visit the schools, to sit in at a council meeting or visit the elders or just sit on the steps at the AC store and talk to kids. I mean, something that for that connection with the communities that we have not been able to do because of our staffing levels.
Okay, and doing more listening?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's part of what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. For all of you just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing law enforcement in rural areas of the state. Do you have experiences with law enforcement? Questions about what could make it better in your community? Give us a call here in Anchorage. It's 550-8422. Outside of Anchorage, it's 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Or you can email talk@alaskapublic.org. So we've been talking a lot about troopers, and we've been talking a lot about VPSOs. The other issue that came up briefly was village patrol officers or tribal police officers. Can we talk a little bit about who fills those roles and what kind of training goes into those roles? We're all...
Sure. So I think Chris and I can talk a little about this. He has a lot of experience in Northwest. So one of the things that we have found, and that I found in my experience in Western Alaska, like I said, spending, you know, 5 years in Bethel and 5 years in Nome, was there's nothing that replaces having somebody in the village. And we don't have enough VPSOs to put a VPSO or a trooper in every village. And so villages have the ability within the state law to appoint a VPO, which is a village police officer. And their certification is governed by the Alaska Police Standards Council. And their training is required in the state, in the statutes and regulations that requires their training.
Can you pause? Yep. The Alaska Police Standards Council?
Yes. So the Alaska Police Standards Council is the governing body that certifies police officers. And so my certification to be a police officer is handled by the Alaska Police Standards Council.
Okay.
Anchorage PD officers, when they go through their training and complete their training, to get their certification to be a police officer, the Alaska Police Standards Council reviews their training curriculum and then gives them their certificate.
And they do the same for all troopers, all VPSOs?
For police officers.
Just police officers.
And so they certify police officers. And so Alaska State Troopers, municipal police officers like Anchorage PD or Palmer PD, those are covered by APSC. VPOs, village police officers, are also governed by APSC. VPSOs are unique because VPSO certification comes through the Department of Public Safety.
Okay.
And so that's basically the commissioner certifies the VPSOs.
Okay.
And so, but a VPO is appointed by their community. And hired by their village, and that can be through a variety of different sources. Some of the villages use federal grant money, so like COPS grant, or they use DOJ, different DOJ funds. And they'll hire a VPO and appoint them to enforce the laws of their community, any ordinances and those kind of things. Or because they're recognized by APSC, they can also enforce state statute. And so they can make arrests, and they work closely hand-in-hand with the Alaska State Troopers in those different communities they serve. So. And that's one of the struggles with the communities is a lot of the communities don't have the infrastructure to do things. And so one of the things that's really exciting is, I don't know if the commissioner was going to announce this or not, but there's a bill that was recently passed. There's going to be a signing this week that helps the Department of Public Safety and Alaska Police Standards Council help those communities that don't have the infrastructure. Because it's required, you know, if you're hiring a police officer, you want to do a background check. You want to run a fingerprint check to make sure that they don't have a record in the state or someplace else that disqualifies them or makes them a risk. And a lot of communities have just hired any individual they can. I think in the story that was written, Kyle quoted me as saying, it's pretty much who's willing and are they able, I mean, physically. And so,
that's Kyle Hopkins who wrote the article for
correct.
The Anchorage Daily News.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And so, and it's a lot of the statement, a community sometimes when they're in need just says, hey, will you do this? Will you take this job? And they'll say, yeah, I'll do it. And they don't run a background check. And then we run into problems with, you know, are they a sexual offender? Have they had a history of other crimes that put them at risk for abusing that position?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, sometimes we see that because those background checks weren't having. And that puts the community at risk as well as the organization, the government, and the individual that shouldn't be in that position. So a VPO works in the community, and we try to build those relationships as troopers to work with them. And funding is also goes up and down. So you get a three-year grant. A community hires a VPO. They work for 2 or 3 years. The grant goes away. They can't find any more money. Mm-hmm. They don't have an infrastructure to support the funding, and so the VPO loses their job until they can find another grant. And so we struggle. And Chris, actually, the Northwest Arctic Borough has done some really innovative work with villages, and I'll let Chris talk about that.
I don't know how innovative, but I'll give all the credit to the Borough Assembly. They have originally started with working with Manelik Corporation to get some of those DOJ grants and use those grant funds to regionally fund the VPO program in each of the communities as a reimbursable fund. So as a community would hire someone and pay their wages through a quarter, they would ask for reimbursement and receive that. Those federal funds went away for the access they were using, and the Borough Assembly has continued to try to help fund these officers in the rural communities that have no other law enforcement in our region.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now over the last 6 months or so, the Borough Assembly and leadership have been looking at ways to help improve the background check process for those communities, because the communities are the ones hiring the officers. Mm-hmm. The borough is not.
Mm-hmm.
And this sounds like a real positive that was just announced, because it kind of takes some of that off of us. It sounds like the state may be doing those or helping with those background checks.
And helping with and fingerprinting and other processes?
Yes, ma'am.
So can you talk a little bit about the process of of hiring a VPO? I mean, it sounds, if you listen to Captain Merrill, it's anyone who's willing and able.
So in a small community, there's 400 or 500 people in some of our communities that have VPOs. There's not a lot of applicants or a very deep mm-hmm. applicant pool. The people who would normally qualify and want to do this kind of work are usually gone. They're off working. In our case, it's usually at Red Dog, or they're off in college if they're young. And so the people that are left behind are great people in a lot of cases, but they don't necessarily want this job. The cities take who they can and who's willing mm-hmm. and do the best they can with that. You need someone to respond in an emergency. And just because someone has a bad background doesn't mean they're bad people within their community. They're not looking at that larger outside picture when mm-hmm. they're hiring someone.
And so if someone comes back with, like the background check comes back, and there are misdemeanors on it or minor felonies, does that automatically disqualify someone, or is it really a case-by-case basis?
You know, with the VPO program, the APSC sets that or has that standard in statute. Mm-hmm. There's a little more flexibility to hire someone who mm-hmm. may have some minor misdemeanors in their past, whereas a municipal officer may not have that flexibility.
Okay.
Yeah, so an example would be, so the standards for like an Alaska State Trooper between a State Trooper and a VPSO are different. And so, for example, a VPSO can have a domestic violence conviction on their record if it's more than 10 years. And so we actually have VPSOs that work in the program that are fantastic VPSOs that have in the past made a mistake, have a domestic violence conviction, and they were charged, convicted, and 10 years later they applied to be a VPSO, and they were hired, and like I said, they are fantastic VPSOs. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of a difference between a trooper and a VPSO. And the VPOs are the same. There's a different standard, and so there's certain convictions that a community member could have. Mm-hmm. They could still be a VPO, but they couldn't be a VPSO or a trooper. And so those standards, and those are in the stat, in the regulations that govern that. And I think Chris hit the nail on the head, is people make mistakes. We arrest people a lot of times, and they've alcohol or other things have caused problems, or they hit a low point in their life, and they've made a bad choice. And most people recover from that. And so we don't judge those individuals who are stepping up in the community to serve their community. Unfortunately, with the positions that we hold and the trust that we're given, there's certain convictions that we just can't overlook. A felony conviction for, say, dishonesty, because we can't come back and say, well, yeah, you have this conviction for dishonesty and you know theft or whatever it may be, and now we're going to have you handling evidence in a murder trial, because that's going to be called into question. And so those convictions are kind of set up in regulation to protect the process. So there are certain convictions that disqualify indefinitely, but generally VPOs have that lower standard. There's not, some of those convictions, we're willing to allow those convictions and keep them working.
Okay. I'd like to turn to the phones now. We have Edward on the line. Edward, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling from Muskmotok, Alaska.
Good morning.
Talking about VPSO programs and VPOs.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Western Alaska. I know VPSO programs have funding for personnel. They do from the state of mm-hmm. Alaska. The problem we have in is they have no housing. No housing. That's why they lost so many good people that protect and serve our communities. The lack of housing. The problem is that. See, that's why you lose good people to protect the villages. Another thing, VPSO program, VPO. Village police officers. I live in a little rural village population of 300.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we're having is the finance money. The tribes that live in the little rural villages have hard time getting funding for their personnel, like EPO, village police officer, TPO, all those goodies. And sometimes we do introductions during holidays, so they wouldn't import new alcohol during winter, holiday season, Christmas, New Year's. And we have lack of funding to protect our people. See, VPO programs, the only cops grant we get is for our chiefs that works with VPO VPSO and the troopers. The from chief, from cops rank, the lower, from chief on down, they have no fundings. They need money to protect, to serve their community.
Edward,
that's what they need to look at. Okay, the housing, especially for VPSO programs, are out in the rural villages.
Mm-hmm. And Edward, I'm going to go ahead and let some of our guests respond to that and see if anything is being done to try to fix the housing problem. Mr. Hatch, is...
Yeah. 5 years ago in the Northwest, we had one village with housing for VPSO. 5 years, 4 years later, we have five communities with housing for VPSO. We've used local funding, state funding, borough funding, and federal funds, along with AHFC funds, to address these needs. It's a continuing need, and it's a continuing need throughout the state. We have to use every option available to us to build housing.
And so that's what's happening up in the Northwest Arctic. Commissioner Monaghan, is there anything happening elsewhere in the state to make sure that there's housing for VPSOs?
That is one of our larger challenges. We also had worked with the AHFC to try to get some housings out there. And we're still trying to come up with some innovative ways. One of the things that we've at least talked about is if, in fact, relying on one of our sister agencies in the state, corrections, for example, bringing back the prison industries where perhaps some skills can be taught, carpentry, be electricians and things like that, and then have them utilize or build, say, modular homes. They used to at one time. And then we could, the trades unions could be doing the training and hiring after they get out of prison. But
or even while in prison.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that I think that we're just exploring. We're hoping that this is something that we as a state can to accomplish to help not only our inmates so that they can get back on the path of feeling that they have some determination of their own future, but as well as giving back to the community by providing, working on homes that we could establish or build and with the corporations where perhaps we can utilize some of the local youth and give them that same training to reassemble these things and, mm-hmm. again, building that confidence and expertise. So we're looking at different ideas.
Is that just sort of a pie in the sky idea at this time, or it's really going to happen?
Well, I know that Commissioner Williams from Department of Corrections, he's been a strong advocate for trying to get this done. And we're seeing what we can do in any way that we can as a state. You know, once we clear this financial hurdle that we're all kind of in a pit about, but we're making progress and we're trying to get something so that we can get this thing done. And that's just one example. Okay. So,
I'd like to go back to the phones. We have Rachel from Anchorage on the line. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. So I know that the legislature appropriated funds to test the 3,500 rape kits that were up to, I guess, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know where that is and what is being done about future prosecution for Alaska women so that these things just don't sit on the shelf. I mean, if there's separate justice for men and women, then I think it's a disparity that should be addressed.
Thank you for your question, Rachel. Commissioner.
Yeah. Actually, Rachel, there's a couple of things on that. They going to the sexual assault kits, the last amount of money that they provided, which, again, thank you, is to help getting some of the local kits from the smaller departments back to the crime lab and so that they can be processed as they should have been a long time ago. So they're working on that. They're working on the mechanisms and the transfers because obviously they have to be what they call maintaining the chain of custody on those things in order to protect the evidentiary value. And in regards to the domestic violence and sexual assault cases, we just had part of the public safety action plan that was put together was to hire two attorneys that would be embedded within the Department of Law solely to handle those particular issues, and investigators as well that would go with that. So we're trying to get, trying to address the needs and concerns that you have, and many others have over these two issues. But believe me, that we are working on that, and we will get it addressed.
Thank you very much for your call, Rachel. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more calls and comments on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing public safety around the state and how to make rural communities even safer. You can join the program by calling us at 1-800-478-8255 statewide or 550-8422 here in Anchorage. We're also taking emails, talk@alaskapublic.org. And we had an individual who called in earlier who had a question about if any tribal people, any individuals involved with the tribes are involved with the decision-making processes in terms of hiring local law enforcement.
So, yeah, I can speak on that a little bit. So it depends on if it's a VPO, then absolutely that local community has full say in who they appoint or hire as a village police officer in their community. Depending on the region of the state, most of our coordinators, so we have 10 organizations that hire VPSOs that we provide the funding for in the state of Alaska. And those 10 organizations have a coordinator like Chris who works for them that works with each community. And so when a community has a VPSO that's eligible to be hired in their community, most of our organizations are including them in the interview process for potential applicants. And so what will happen is we'll do the screening process to make sure they meet the minimum qualifications, and then the communities will participate in an interview with that VPSO telephonically or in person, depending on the circumstances. And the community has a say. They get to say, yeah, we think they're going to be a good fit in our community. And if the person's not a good fit for the community, then they have the opportunity to decline having that VPSO. Because one of the parts of the VPSO program that sometimes gets overlooked is the state provides the funding. The grantee or the organization hires, like, Northwest Arctic Borough or, say, Kowarik or AVCP in the Bethel region, hire the VPSO, and they're an employee of that organization. But there also has to be a memorandum of agreement between the village and the employer to have that VPSO in there, and who's going to provide, you know, office space and those kind of things. And so if a community doesn't like the VPSO that's being hired or working, then they have an absolute say in whether that person can be in their community and serve them.
And Chris, what kind of training do people receive, like, especially if it's someone who's not from Alaska? How do you prepare them and make sure that they are respectful?
That begins with the interview process, the application process. When we first talk to people, you try to judge and get a feel for how they'll fit in the region and in the places they're going to be. Obviously, you're familiar with them, and you try to become as familiar as you can with the person you're interviewing from 3,000 miles away sometimes. After they've been hired, they come to the region, they've been accepted, okay, that'll work in our community, we want him or her. They go to ALET training. They complete the full 15 weeks.
ALET training?
Alaska Law Enforcement Training at the Public Safety Academy in Sitka. Mm-hmm. All municipal trooper and VPSOs are trained there. Then they go through a three-week fire and EMS academy, so they're certified as rural fire protection specialists and ETTs at the minimum. Then we take them out for field training, and part of the field training in the Northwest is 40 hours of socialization in the region to provide that kind of context for where they'll be living.
All right. I'd like to turn back to the phones. We have Marsha from Petersburg on the line. Marsha, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I have several questions, comments. Number one, what is the age limits for being a VPSO?
What are the age limits?
Well, for a VPO and TPO, actually VPO is basically just 19. For a VPSO and a state trooper or municipal police officer, it's 21.
All right.
And is there an upper range on that or just the minimum?
I believe it all depends on the individual's physical state as well as her mental state. I can tell you from my prior experience when I was with the Anchorage Police Department, we hired an individual who was 56 years old, and he did outstanding.
Well, that's encouraging. As we know, sometimes you have to have those life experiences before you can really be good at your job. One of my thoughts is on the housing. We all know that housing in the bush is tough. But I like that idea about using inmates, former inmates, and teaching them skills. And the new trend for some time now is tiny houses. It doesn't have to be grandiose. It just has to be a nice, serviceable home. So there's that thought. And then I'm aware that sometimes you have one officer that services several villages and flies out to their service areas. One thought comes there, because I've been in Alaska Aviation for 40-plus years, why not solicit Alaska Airmen's Association, see if there's one of those pilots that is retiring, that has a plane, that would love to donate their plane to this project.
Yeah, that's an outstanding idea. Alaska Airmen's.
Could you repeat
that? There's some Alaska Airmen out there or former pilots, or somebody's got some planes sitting around. We all know that we can use more planes out in the bush, especially for VPSOs to get to those areas.
I made a note of it. Thank you, Marsha.
Thank you for your call, Marsha. And now we have on the line Jane from Copper Basin. Jane, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, thanks. I just want to give the troopers an attaboy out here and say that they do a phenomenal job. You know, they patrol the area about the size of West Virginia, and with their limited resources, I can only say good things about them. And I have a couple comments. Regarding recruitment, I think the public needs to take some responsibility for the way the media, the news, movies, TV, it's very fashionable to show police in a negative light. And when I grew up, you know, they were always the heroes of the TV shows, the movies. And let's face it, you know, 95% of these guys get into this because they want to do what's best for the community. So, you know, people who don't encourage their children, don't encourage their neighbors to say, hey, when you want a policeman or a law enforcement officer, you know, they're going to be here for you. But instead, it's easier to point out the negativity. So I think that's a public perception that they need to acknowledge, you know, they're part of this recruitment problem nationwide. And the other thing is the judicial system kicks a lot of these people back, right back to the communities, whether they're villages or towns or cities. You know, these are a lot of repeat offenders that take a lot of time of law enforcement, and it takes it away from, you know, where we really need these guys to be posted. So, you know, let's also look at what we're doing with criminals as far as just kicking them down the road, reducing sentences, and putting them right back on the street so these guys have to deal with them, and women, over and over again. So anyway, those are my ideas, comments. I'd like to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jane, for calling in. Are there misconceptions that you feel like should be addressed?
So I would have to agree with Jane, and I appreciate her comments, because the majority of us getting this job, not for the money and not for the fame, but because we want to help our communities. And it's interesting, I just was actually, a lot of us volunteer our time with Boy Scouts and with youth groups and other things. And one of my favorite things to tell people that frustrates me as a police officer is when I'm in uniform and I'm walking through the mall, and a mother looks at me and looks at her little son or her daughter and says, "You see him? If you do anything bad, he's going to arrest you and throw you in jail." And I'm thinking to myself, what I'd really like you to say is, let me introduce you to this trooper, because if you ever need help, this is the person you should go ask for help. And so Jane kind of hits on the head. Right now, the media portrays us. If you look at all the movies, it's about cops breaking the law, cops stealing stuff, cops shooting people, cops being bad. And while that does happen, and while it is fashionable, it's not the truth. And so what our message is we want youth and people to see us as, we're serving your community, and we're out being guardians. We're trying to help our community. And if we can get the community to see us that way, then we can build those relationships as opposed to being opposed. We can be partners in working, because she's correct. It's a relationship between communities and law enforcement so that we can do our job best.
I guess I want to push back a little on the idea that it's fashionable to show police officers in a bad light. I mean, there are national public conversations around relationships between law enforcement and communities, especially communities of color, for a reason.
Well, if I can toss in a little bit on that, you know, one of the things that law enforcement as a profession does is that we have literally thousands and thousands and thousands of contacts with individuals all across the country every day. And what the vast majority of them, the very vast majority of them, are done exactly as how they're supposed to be. And there's sometimes, let me give you a quick example, one that I experienced recently. I was stopped at a store to pick up some bread, and across from me was an Anchorage police officer had stopped and was talking to a driver, kind of situated kitty corner in a parking spot from me. Mm-hmm. And he was just talking through the window, and she was gripping the steering wheel and just staring straight ahead. There wasn't any violence. There wasn't anything going wrong. And he obviously did need my help, so I went in and got the bread. When I came back out, there was a second officer talking to the other side of the car through the open window, again trying to induce her to come on out of the car, apparently. I could not back out of my spot because there was a string of cars going behind me, traveling slowly with their phones out the window, looking for something. Mm-hmm. So it is we're not measured by our success, because success is expected. We are apparently measured by our failures, which we will have it occasionally. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it operates. And it's not just all police. There's a lot of professions that you always want to have your doctor to be the right person, fix mm-hmm. everything. Your sports team have to win every game. You know, it's just human nature that way.
So this goes back to something that kind of came up earlier about building relationships mm-hmm. and building trust within the organization and within the community. So, Mr. Hatch, could you talk a little bit about things that have successfully done that?
The VPSO program's greatest strength is its ability to build partnerships in the communities. Excuse me. Over time, it's been proven that the more time you spend working with the people of the community, getting to know them, the easier these contacts become and the less interference, as it were, that's what the commissioner just described, mm-hmm. Happens. Spending time with the children in the schools is the best way to get to know the families in our small communities, and that's what we try to focus on as much as possible. Obviously, time is taken up with criminal acts and responding to them, but in a general sense, that's what we work to build is relationships.
And I'd like to go back to the phone lines. We have Candy from Homer on the line. Candy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. I just have a question, because you've spoken quite a bit about community, and I'm wondering if there has been an attempt at updating community service plans for programs that help launch people so that you can have strong teams of people that work together as mentors and coaches. I mean, we have vocational rehabilitation, we have community mental health, we have teachers, and we have coaches. And when you have people come together and review plans and say, what are we actually doing? Because I think you touched on earlier job training and job skills. And education has to start young. And I've always felt that, you know, work is good for people. It gives them a sense of self-worth, and it empowers them to do better and become parts of their community. But I'm wondering where community service people come in supporting your efforts, what you do, because really, actually, you should be doing the policing and the outreach in your line of expertise. But we have so many programs and so many other experts that it would behoove us all if we all came together and helped get these young people launched into a career plan. And I would just like a little discussion about that.
Well, Candy, I agree with you that the concept of active communities are that are intentionally and working towards the betterment of themselves and that community are far more braced or strengthened that would prohibit a lot of the crime and disorder that happens or that's afflicting many of our communities. You see, it's apathy is kind of like crime and disorder's best ally. And as long as people are active in the community and they're all engaged in it and working with that, you're going to find a safer community. It's just a nature of a thing. In fact, the concept of modern policing, when it was first derived way back in, 1863 or something akin to that, in England, Sir Robert Peel, he basically has this thing that says the police are the people and the people are the police. The police are the only ones who do it full time. So what he was trying to say is that it's everybody's responsibility for public safety, everybody's, and public safety in all aspects, whether it be fire, whether it be juvenile issues or whatever it is. And so the more active the community is, the safer that community is going to be.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your call. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more calls on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we are talking about public safety around the state. We're taking your calls at 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email talk@alaskapublic.org. There has been a recent statute change coming through the legislature. It's SB 148. Commissioner Monaghan, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what that was.
Well, I'd love to, actually. There was... Again, thanks to the legislature and to the governor for getting this across the line. But this is what was kind of alluded to earlier in trying to obtain the ability for communities to reach out and make sure that the person they're hiring does meet the standards. It's many of the smaller communities do not have the relationship with the federal government to run individuals, you know, background checks and fingerprints and whatnot. He usually has to go through something else. What this does is opens up the Alaska Police Standards Council to have the authority so that they can take the application, the fingerprints, and run people and get back to the communities with that. So, and that's going to be a bill signing that is going to happen this coming Thursday out in Bethel.
And so this was mentioned a little bit earlier in terms of making it more feasible to do background checks. Are there other things happening at the state level that will really help smaller communities around the state? Any other aspects of safety action plans?
One of the things that we are working in, it's according to the Public Safety Action Plan, is to examine and start the practice of cross-deputization, meaning that... what you do is that, like, a VPSO could actually enforce tribal law.
Oh.
If there's an active tribal court in that community, that the VPSO could do the obviously the state charges, but if it's it seems more appropriate to go through the tribal system than the individual who has been arrested or charged with whatever the violation is willing to do that, it can happen. And it's trying to empower the community to take responsibility for its own public safety.
And I've heard of various different tribal courts around the state. Are you going to be expanding these relationships so that other communities can also have them? Smaller communities could have tribal courts?
Yes, we encourage that. The state has come up with the Civil Diversion Agreement, which basically is an agreement between the state and a community that we will work in partnership for smaller violations that could be handled civilly versus criminally.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a crime of disorder, you know, something that violates that that the state probably would not really take, or it would be so far down on the priority list, the community can have the satisfaction of actually taking action and imposing some civil sanction, chopping wood for the elders or helping somebody redo their boat or house or something, mm-hmm. whatever the community desires. And so this is a formal agreement that is signed between the state and the individual tribes. And we're hoping that continues to grow, because it's a partnership that has been long overdue.
All right, and I would like to go back to the phones. We have Alex on the line from Southeast.
Yes, hello.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of issues. One, I wanted to make a suggestion towards your modular housing option.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing a lot in the lower 48 is using these Connex units that they get from large shipping terminals. They end up can get them for next to nothing, and by retrofitting them into apartment type housing, they're able to set up housing in real short order of time. That might be an option for either the prison employees or just private contractors to be able to set up for your housing for your remote communities. They can be delivered by a tractor trailer available or a heli crane if not. And the other question I had previously been a law enforcement officer and 911 paramedic in the lower 48 and a rescue team captain for a fire department. Fire marshal came up here to work as a tech medic for the pipeline, and my ex-wife at the time when we were still married got an illegal CPO, civil protective order against me by committing perjury, and I had appealed it, and I wanted to return to work at the pipeline, and because the judge, despite saying that he didn't believe, there had been ever been any domestic violence, because there hadn't, he let it remain in effect. So that kind of cut me out of either going to work for the troopers, which I'd like to have done, or the VPSO. So I didn't know if there was something that if another individuals out there and they run into a similar problem, if y'all had some venue for trying to rectify that, because I'd gone to the state district attorney and even the federal district attorney, and neither one of them would prosecute perjury in CPO cases.
Alex, we're going to go ahead and let Captain Merrill address you.
So absolutely, Alex. Thanks for your call. And the Connex idea is an absolutely fantastic idea. It's actually one that Chris had sent me an email about a month ago about a company that's doing that in Wasilla. And so those are an idea that we're actually examining right now. So great minds think alike. For the conviction, so if it's not a criminal conviction, if it's a criminal conviction of a domestic violence crime, after 10 years, you're eligible to become a VPSO. You wouldn't be eligible for a trooper position, but you could be eligible for a VPSO position. But in this case, it sounds like it was simply a protective order, which wasn't an actual criminal charge against you. So for those that are in your similar position, those are absolutely something that you can apply. And if someone has a question, they can always call the VPSO office, my office. If you go online, Alaska State Troopers VPSO, it will give you our office. And if you think that you have a situation that might warrant consideration, we absolutely can look at that to see if it fits the eligibility requirements.
All right. Alex, thank you very much for your call.
You too. God bless.
There's been a lot of conversation focusing around housing and housing being a major challenge. Are there other challenges that
that people face?
Infrastructure in general in rural Alaska can be very limited. So several of our communities have limited public safety buildings, holding cells that are inadequate, substandard, no running water, no toilets, et cetera. So it's not just housing, but it's all the infrastructure involved in keeping someone there, a garage to keep your vehicles safe and warm and running so you can respond in a timely manner in the cold of winter. Mm-hmm. All of these things are needed to provide the same level of response you'd get anywhere else.
Going to the issue of holding cells, does every community have something if they need to hold a suspect?
There's usually something in a community. What that something may be, I can't answer for you.
So we did a survey a year and a half ago now, where we went around and we tried to, at least in all of EPSO villages, try to determine what facilities existed for holding cells, office spaces, and it was actually pretty disheartening. We had VPSOs working in buildings that had floors that were falling out. We had a VPSO that lives in a community where they couldn't keep the building warm. Even with a Toyo stove running, they couldn't keep it warm enough. And so he was taking prisoners home and handcuffing them to a wood chair in his house because he didn't have options. And so one of the things that we've done as the VPSO program is when organizations that employ VPSOs identify that, if we have money that we haven't spent throughout the year, we use some of that money to help fix some of those problems as we're able to. The goal of the program is to hire as many VPSOs and have them serving as we can. But if we have that money available, we've tried to fix housing. We've tried to fix some office spaces as much as we can. But they're expensive projects. You're talking in the bush, a 2x4 costs, you know, $10 or $15 as opposed to $3. And so it's a lot more expensive, but we try to make those repairs as we can based on the funding sources that we have available. But yeah, infrastructure is a significant challenge.
Just, if I may, just to emphasize that point, we built a 2-bedroom duplex, so 2 bedrooms on either side in Ambler, Alaska, 2 years ago, and total cost was $989,000. So transportation of goods, workers, and building the infrastructure for that housing unit is extremely expensive in rural Alaska.
And we only have a minute left, but we've talked a lot about law enforcement. Is there any money going towards prevention now?
Well, hopefully this is one of the things that we want to try to do with our visits and talking to kids and having VPSOs go into the classrooms. The idea is educate to know where that boundary line is, and it's always a project.
All right. I would like to thank everyone who called into the program today. I'd also like to thank my guests. We had Department of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, Village Public Safety Officer Captain Andrew Merrill, and Chris Hatch, who is the VPSO Coordinator for the Northwest Arctic Borough. Thank you all for being here. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Wesley Early was on phones. I'm Ann Hillman, and this was Talk of Alaska. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.